political change in Britain. The story on NPR is All Things Considered. Neither the Labour nor the Conservative Party has a clear majority in today's parliamentary elections in Britain. A hung parliament is in the making. 50 years ago, as part of the Lend-Lease effort to help Russia, the Alcan Highway was built up through the Yukon to Alaska. Many of the troops were black from the south, a complete surprise to the native population.
One morning they woke up at Metasta Lake and heard the bulldozers coming and had no idea what to expect, and then saw this crew of black engineers coming in. And one old-timer made this wonderful statement about the first white men we ever saw were black.
Also, letters from listeners coming up on All Things Considered and this news. 50 years ago, there was need of a highway. It was a daunting idea, up through the Yukon to Alaska. It had to be done fast. It was wartime. The road was built.
This highway, stretching from Dawson Creek on the British Columbia, Alberta line, to Fairbanks in the core of Alaska, is a real and unique tie between our countries. This project was born in the hour of Pearl and produced for military purposes.
Brigadier General James O'Connor. The ceremony to open the road was held November 20th, 1942, and covered by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
The ends of the ribbon are held by four of the American soldiers who built the highway. They are Sergeant Major Sharp, a Negro soldier, and Private Alfred Jalufka of Kennedy, Texas, who are from the northern sector of the road, and Master Sergeant Andrew E. Doyle of Philadelphia and Corporal John T. Riley of Detroit, another Negro sector, representing the southern end of the road. As a matter of fact, Private Alfred Jalufka is the man who completed the road. He knocked down the last tree in...
That was in November of 1942. As an engineering challenge, the highway was compared to the Panama Canal, a highway 1,500 miles long, rammed through unmapped mountainous territory, built on earth that turned to treacherous mud in the summer, frustrating ice in the winter. The road had been talked about for many years, the idea of connecting Alaska to the lower 48, but it was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and the sighting of Japanese submarines in Alaska waters that convinced the U.S. and Canadian governments to get started. The United States was sending aircraft to Russia under the Lend-Lease plan, 8,000 American planes. There was already a string of airfields from Montana out through the Aleutian Islands, but a highway was needed to connect those airfields and for trucking in supplies for the Alaska military bases. The United States sent 7 regiments from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They were joined by thousands of civilian construction workers and contractors from the United States and Canada. Walter Mason was a lieutenant with the 97th Engineers Regiment A Company.
We had just come off of a troop train from Pensacola to Seattle, and we boarded a ship called the David W. Branch and went up the Inside Passage, which is a beautiful trip. The mountains coming down to the water, the evergreen forest and all that. But it was an uncertain period, you know, going away from home. We were on there with hundreds of men that didn't know where they were going at that moment, and going up the passageway, then cross the Gulf of Alaska on a ship that had marks of an encounter with a Japanese submarine on a previous trip. So there was some nervousness, but it was a great adventure I had been to sea before.
The 97th Engineers landed at the port of Valdez, Alaska, at the end of April 1942. With snow still filling the passes of the Alaska Range, they had to wait for a month in camp before starting the real work on the road. Walter Mason was a mechanical engineer and motor officer for A Company. He helped train the men to operate the heavy equipment, power shovels, dump trucks, and big D8 bulldozers, at the time the largest tractors Caterpillar built. But everybody had to relearn building techniques to meet the special demands of the Alaskan terrain.
After we were out about 20 miles, we began to hit muskeg. And muskeg is a frozen tundra, a frozen ground, covered over with moss. If you uncover it, The sun will melt this frozen earth under the moss, and it becomes soup and mud. And our first inclination was to uncover it, try to shove the dirt off of it when it melted, and then you just gradually built a canal out across the tundra. But the word came down anyway to handle muskeg. Don't drive over it or do anything. Just cut trees, or what we call corduroy, and there was plenty of them available. Lay down across it, and then get a gravel bed over these trees, and then you can drive your vehicles over that. And that's still the way they handle muskeg in Alaska.
The soldiers had their own name for muskeg. They called it quicksand because it sometimes swallowed trucks and heavy equipment. In some places, the road was forced into consecutive hairpin turns to avoid the soggy ground. But as they grew accustomed to the terrain, the 97th Engineers built up speed. A company would lead the way, breaking trail. Other companies followed on, building culverts and ditches. Eventually, they were laying 5 miles of road a day. But the soldiers faced other difficulties.
Well, I tell you, it was really rough.
Fred Spencer was a private in the 93rd Regiment, D Company. His unit was working on the Canadian side of the border near the town of Whitehorse. He spent 8 months on the highway.
Mosquitoes, black flies were terrible in living conditions, you know, in what little summer we had. It was full of nothing but insects. We didn't have mosquito nets and stuff like that, and we suffered until they could get that stuff, you know.
Fred Spencer and the men of his unit worked 12-hour shifts 7 days a week. They felled trees with saws and axes, sometimes used hand tools to break the ground. Spencer found the work so exhausting, he says the only good times came when he'd go to sleep. At first, the soldiers had no radios and no news of the outside world. Then they began receiving the Yank, an Army newspaper, which told them the Japanese bombers had attacked the U.S. naval station at Dutch Harbor in Alaska, and that thousands of Japanese troops invaded the Aleutian Islands of Attu and Kiska in July. By October, cold was setting in. That winter would be the worst on record, reaching 70 degrees below zero on some parts of the highway. For Fred Spencer, who spent all of his life in Florida, it was a new experience.
Man, you had to wear protection all the time. You had to wear gloves. On the mittens, we had mittens. We wore over gloves. When you were eating, you had to have on your gloves. And it would just... It was that all the, you were completely covered all the time.
Fred Spencer was one of the thousands of black soldiers who made up a third of the U.S. forces sent to work on the highway. They were at first the subject of fierce debate within the military command. Lael Morgan teaches journalism at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. She has spent years researching the history of the highway, especially the role of the black soldiers.
A good number of black troops had no chance at education and were considered to be pretty hopeless. They were kind of resigned to what they called housekeeping duty stateside. The records show that they were not to go into active duty. They didn't trust them there. They didn't think that they had brains enough to drive a bulldozer. When the Alaska Highway came, they needed manpower they didn't have, because our death toll in Europe had been higher than expected. And so they decided to send in these black regiments. They did so over the protests of the commanding general in Alaska, Simon Beauvoir Buckner, whose father had surrendered to Grant during the Civil War. Buckner didn't want these troops up here. He was had reservations about their ability to perform. He also was afraid that they would mix with the local population and put out the worst-looking race in the history of the world, is the way he expressed it in writing.
General Buckner was persuaded that the highway could not be built without the black soldiers, and he allowed them into Alaska on one condition, that they not go near any cities or towns. The highway pushed through parts of Alaska and Canada populated by Native Americans, some of whom had never seen outsiders before.
One morning they woke up at Metasta Lake and heard the bulldozers coming and had no idea what to expect, and then saw this crew of black engineers coming in. And one old-timer made this wonderful statement about the first white men we ever saw were black.
Some Native communities were devastated by diseases brought by the outsiders, measles, pneumonia, dysentery, for which they had no immunity. In the native village of Teslin, 8 successive epidemics killed half the children under 5 years old. But elsewhere, says Lael Morgan, the highway was welcomed.
There's a fellow who runs the Native Network station in Whitehorse, Ken Kane, who says anybody who is anybody in our Native community lived on the highway because it gave us a chance to get out and to mix and mingle with the rest of the world.
Stories about the Alcan Highway sometimes put the military death toll from accidents and cold weather as high as 200. Walter Mason does not believe that. He says in his regiment of 1,200 men and 50 officers, only two lost their lives.
One of them was a case where a man had been harassed by his buddies. They all lived in a tent, and he was so upset, he sat down on the tent and said, "I'm going to shoot the next man comes to the door." It wasn't really a fight. It was just a man feeling so depressed and harassed that he just said he's going to do that. And the next man that came through happened to be his best buddy, but he still did it.
Another member of Mason's regiment died of hypothermia after his pickup truck broke down. The man had violated a cardinal rule: never go on the road without survival equipment. He froze to death trying to walk back to camp. But despite the adverse conditions, the road was finished in just 8 months. Bulldozers coming from the north and the south met in the forest outside Beaver Creek in the Yukon on the 29th of October. The Alcan Highway is still the main road to Alaska. The gravel is now pavement. The worst curves and steepest grades have been smoothed out. But drivers still consider it a challenge to negotiate the long, desolate stretches of road with few services. Walter Mason has returned to drive the highway four times. He now has two children living in Alaska.
I find it quite difficult to travel back, but I see landmarks and sites, places that I distinctly remember things that I did at that particular point. And I actually went down in the summer of 60. My wife and I went with our son down over the road, and he took pictures of me standing holding photographs that I took in 1942 on the exact same spot at that time. But it's difficult to carry myself back that far. On the other hand, the whole adventure is very fresh still in my mind. I can't realize 50 years has gone by since then.
Walter Mason, motor officer of the 97th Engineers Regiment, A Company, recalling the building of the Alaska-Canada Highway in 1942.
The signal has been given from the speaker stand for the huge trucks to start rolling down the steep incline behind us here, past the boundary line, and roar onto Fairbanks. The first convoy to push through. Here they come now, and as they pass our truck here, I'll let you hear them. And there they go, roaring off into the snowy distance. The first convoy of Fairbanks freight, symbolic of the hundreds of thousands that will follow along this trail, carrying to the strategic bases of Alaska the weapons of war that will surely smash our enemies in the Pacific. This broadcast from the official opening of the Alcan Road originated at Soldiers' Summit near the international border and was recorded by the CBC's Features Department. The broadcast was heard by listeners in the United States through the mutual...
Things considered, Jillian Merlin of Marietta, Georgia, writes in about the hospital in the Northwest Territories, Canada, accused of performing abortions without adequate anesthesia. Miss Merlin says, "I have never heard anything so ghastly and grisly. My first thought was to get hold of that hospital board and give them all vasectomies without the benefit of anesthesia. Wonder why I'm assuming they are all men." From Linnea Priest of Frankfort, Michigan, "I heard with interest your profile of Hillary Rodham Clinton. I'm glad to hear she is concerned about children. As a former pediatrician, I am also concerned about children. That is why I'm opposed to free trade with Mexico, a country where children are exploited for cheap labor under unsafe conditions. I hope that the Clintons can reconcile their trade platform with their consciences." Our interview about the new commercial driver's license required of truck drivers on the 1st of April brought this from Lee Klass, a driver out of Portland, Oregon. For a political party that long has had a philosophy of keeping government off people's backs, you sure couldn't tell it by us. This current Republican administration, as well as its predecessor, has incessantly been on our backs, in our pants, urine testing, and in our wallets. This nation has many problems, but our performance is not one of them. This from Charles Curry of Hubbard, Ohio. In your feature on Mexican ejidos, or agricultural cooperatives, you several times referred to the ejido as ipso facto inefficient and a wasteful means of agricultural production. You also featured a cooperative farmer saying that socialism was a failure. You cannot, of course, be held responsible for the opinions of those you quote. Still, there's a lot to be said yet in favor of socialism as a counterweight to private systems of wealth getting. The record of capitalistic farming in America seems to show it is not the farmers but the shippers, the wholesalers, and the processors who get rich. Charles Galt of Long Beach, California writes about the recycling of manure at the Memphis Zoo and other zoos around the country. We had mentioned that we didn't know if there was a zoo in Portland, Oregon. Mr. Galt says, although I am only an occasional but very fond visitor to Portland, I learned in 1987 that the Portland Zoo recycles its zoo do in the famed and lovely Portland Rose Garden. Indeed, I even frequently wear a zoo do t-shirt I bought in that year, and a small can of dried zoo do marketed by the Made in Oregon shops sits on my mantelpiece. It's a great idea, but it's not new, although Memphis may be taking it farther. And from Pat Michaels of San Francisco, the idea of zoo do is not new. It was done by San Fran's Foggy Zoo